we were talking with Mr. Seal, there were so many questions we had of him that he said that you could answer better than he could. And now I forget what the questions were. But if you would state your name and your position for the record.
David Englewood. I'm the intake officer, one of the intake officers for the Superior Court for the 4th District.
Madam Chair. As I recall, what prompted inviting Mr. Lewis was to try to find out how the Juvenile Act was working up here.
Runaway.
And the runaway thing. Right.
Those were the two things, that how the Juvenile Act and the runaway, whether you're having any problems with the present runaway act.
Well, the only problem that I see at this point is confusion. I've had several parents call recently indicating they called the police, and the police asking that their children be found and picked up, brought down to the station so they could pick them up, and the police telling them that they could not pick up children for runaway, which I think is just confusion in the repeal of the original runaway law, and then the issuance of the law that was just prior to this one. I don't know the numbers, where the police could not pick up a child for simply being a runaway juvenile. And then the reinstatement of the law as I stand it now, which was kind of modified from the original law, where police officers or peace officers could apprehend a juvenile for being a runaway and at least keep control of the situation until parents or guardians could be found or the proper juvenile authorities contacted and disposition made. So that this has been the biggest problem that we've noted, at least from our office. It's gotten to the point at one time where any time a juvenile ran away, the parents would call the police, the police would refer them to us, wanting us to issue a court order to have the child picked up, which was a lot of needless paperwork and red tape to accomplish something that should have been accomplished by a report to the police agency. And that seems to be the biggest problem that we're having right at this point. This confusion.
The belief of the police that they are not allowed under the current laws to pick up runaways.
Right. And this mostly seems to be from the troopers. We've talked to them a couple times, but we just, for example, last week had two girls that ran away from Anchorage came to Fairbanks Little Fair. During the course of their stay at the fair, one of the girls had seizures, and she was epileptic, so she went to the hospital. And the mothers found out she's in the hospital after a call from the doctor. So the mothers called the troopers, asked that the girls be placed in custody so that they could know that they were there, and at that point they were going to send airplane tickets so the girls could return home. And the police told them they couldn't pick them up, and they couldn't take him into custody, which is the most recent case that's happened. But I bet, and the mother finally got my number. She called about 8 or 9 different people. She finally called me and she said, can you please do something? I've got a child in Fairbanks that I want back in Anchorage, and I'd like to have picked up. We did call the city police, and the city police went over and made sure the one girl was in the hospital, and made arrangements that the hospital would keep an eye on her so she wouldn't slip out on him, although at that point the girl wanted to go home, so there wasn't any problem as far as custody. And we had plane tickets that night, and then the city police picked him up that evening and took him out to the airport and placed him on the airplane.
There is a misconception then, because that was not the intent of the law.
Right.
However, this is one thing that we have to get straightened out, because this, not only this is happening, but you had cases where the child runs away from home. You would be the intake officer in that case. And perhaps, you know, every kid wants to run away from home. So, I mean, that's the thing. If they don't do it when they're 13, they'll do it when they're 30. But they'll run away. You know? I have a girlfriend that's 56, and said to her husband, I'm going to run away from home. You know, I've never tried it, and I just feel like running away. So that's just about it. But so they're going to run away sometime. But in some of the areas, the problem seems to be that rather than take them home, of course, if they find out they're abused and they find out home life is bad, they shouldn't, you know, they shouldn't be forced home. But home is usually better than any other place they put them. How do you feel? What do you do when they... like to know how you handle it up here.
Yeah, as I understand the intent of the law that repealed the long-standing runaway law, as I'm looking into it, I understand that what prompted the revision in the law was they found some cases where kids had run away and were placed back home by the police or other agencies into incestuous situations or abuse situations. And so that, as I understand, the intent of the new law was to prevent this from happening. But it seemed to have gone, you know, the whole arc to where then you couldn't do anything. And the kid who was running away because they didn't like spinach for supper then had the opportunity to do anything he wanted. And so, you know, it's been kind of confusing in that respect. What we do is when a child's picked up, the general policy that's operated in Fairbanks, as I know it, is we'll talk to the child. Now, if the child refuses to go home, then we'll look into alternate placement, at least right at that point, and investigate and find out why. If it's just because the child doesn't like spinach and they have spinach 5 nights a week, then he may be in a situation where he's forced home. If it's because of other problems, then it's a matter of looking into the other problems, whether the abuse, physical or you know, whatever the abuse might be, or emotional or whatever, if there's a real family problem, or if the family unit's to a point where it cannot function in a normal manner with the child and the parents together, then of course alternate placement will be looked into. Right now, the only immediate alternate placement we have is detention. We used to have a facility called Youth Incorporated where we could put kids who didn't have any other place to go but who didn't necessarily need to be locked up. Right at this point, we have no facility other than the state jail for kids temporarily. And so usually that's what happens the first day or two until the matter can be looked into. And sometimes the kids prefer that to home, and sometimes legitimately. But the majority of the time, it's the other way around. The problem mostly lies with the kids, you know, in some rebellion or whatever, you know, may have caused them to feel this way. We have gone into court on a few occasions with a couple kids that have, the only reason they aren't home is because they're just spoiled. They were either going to get their way or leave home. And it's a common conception around town among some of the rowdier elements that it's easy to manipulate the state. If you don't like it at home, run away. And keep running away, and pretty soon they'll put you in a foster home. And foster homes are a lot easier than home. And I've heard this many times. And we've had girls and boys that have tried this, and more girls because it happened to be one particular group that infiltrates the whole area, or that a lot of the girls associate with. And in a couple cases, then we've taken this, in one case, specifically one girl who had a fine family, you know, that really loved her and really cared, but would not tolerate the things she was doing, and the things she were doing was wrong. And so she knew some of these other girls, and they had told her that if you run away enough, you get a foster. And it got to the point where it was ludicrous to consider spending the $234 a month to put her in a foster home to get her own way, or keep shipping her from foster home to foster home. And she was told to go back home by the court. And she wouldn't, so she was detained until such a time as she decided. Well, a few days later, she decided she'd go home. And that's been 4 months now, 5 months, and there's been absolutely no problem. The girl's been doing real well. I think she realized that things would not be tolerated, that she's going to have to behave in an acceptable manner, do what is normally expected of anybody. And the family's doing real well.
Then the detention of a couple days didn't hurt at all.
No. A lot would depend, too, on who's in detention. Sometimes detention is a real fine therapeutic tool, if it's used right, in the respect that you get a child that's running away quite often, who's on the go, out in the street, or doing whatever he's doing. They don't have time to really stop and think, and I mean really think. It's just reacting to one situation to the next, just a constant, ongoing thing. And if they're placed in a situation like detention, where for the first 24 hours they're isolated until a doctor can check them over to make sure there's no communicable diseases, they have absolutely nothing to do but think or sleep. And it really gives them a time to reflect on what's been going on. A lot of the kids, once they have this opportunity, are sensible enough to really sit down and figure out which is what. And in that respect, I think at times it can be helpful. I think it can be a disservice if it's abused, if a child, it gets to the point where it's mundane, or a child can become institutionalized where there's a lot of security in a situation like that. You know where you're going to eat, you know where you're going to sleep, you know that you're going to be taken care of and put to bed and got up, and it takes a lot of responsibility off the child. At first it might seem unpleasant, but then the kids can rationalize, and there's a pool table over there, and there's TV, and there's puzzles, and they bring movies in, and they have school there. So pretty soon it becomes a lifestyle, and it's not all that bad. And when it gets to that point, then it's useless, because then it doesn't serve any purpose except putting them in a little box, keeping them out of everybody's hair for a while.
What percentage of the runaways do you find are abused children? I mean, approximately.
I don't know. I think on the runaway board at the police station, I think they average about 20 to 30 kids a month. I mean, there's usually about that number, about 20 kids on the board. Some will run away, some will come back, some will stay gone a long time. And I think probably, I'd say it was a real small percentage. I'd hate to even hazard a guess, because I wouldn't know. I can only remember since the first of the year, maybe four or five cases of where there was actual abuse or something like that in this area that I know about. Now, sometimes a runaway may go directly to the welfare office. I don't think this is happening very much or at all anymore. But right after the other law was out, I know it was happening on a regular basis. Kids would go in and complain about things, and there'd be investigations and so forth. But I think it's a very small percentage that I know of right at this point. Most of the kids that are running away that I know of are kids that are starting to run with some pretty heavy kids, wanting more freedom and a free type lifestyle and whatever that might be, to roam and wander and do their thing. And very few of them.
That would be about 4 or 5 out of 240 a month.
Yeah.
If you're going to on the 20 to 30 row.
Yeah, I would say maybe 4 or 5% at the most, that I know of.
That would be high, wouldn't it?
It probably would be. I don't know what the national average is. I was just reading a pamphlet the other day. I took my boy over to get immunization for school, and they had a pamphlet on child abuse neglect. I think it said Alaska had 50-some reported cases, 53 or something like that, the last year, which was just about the national average. And they figured it up to be 43 per 100,000 population or something. I can't remember. Maybe it was 102 or 103, but it was about 43 or 44 per 100,000 in population, and I think the national average was somewhere right in that range somewhere, too.
Let's say, I think the judge in Anchorage said about 0.5%.
I was just going to ask, aren't we talking here about, from the numbers you gave us, we're talking about a fraction of 1%.
Yeah, fraction.
Instead of 4 or 5%.
Yeah,
right.
Fraction of 1%.
A fraction of 1%.
Yeah, I meant 4 or 5 out of all of them that I
increased.
You said about 35 a month.
Yeah.
And there's been 4 or 5 maybe since the first of the year.
Yeah. Now, this doesn't mean we know all the cases either, but out of the runaways that we've talked to, we're able to determine there's problems. I think that's...
Then why do you... I'm putting you on the spot. But then why... is it that there's so many of the runaways are put in foster homes, say, fraction of 1%?
I think maybe it's because everybody, that's the easiest thing to do, really. Because if you put the kid back home and the kid keeps running, then you pick him up, put him back home, and keeps running. And every time they quit running, they come back, they want a foster home. And then eventually, I think a lot of times it's just out of frustration because he's been put home so many times. And yet, if the only offense the child's committed is runaway, you really don't have enough to institutionalize him or really make any other placement other than home. And, you know, you don't want to put him in jail for too long a period of time because that, first of all, doesn't do any good, and you're also limited by statute, you know, how long you can keep him in detention. I think that's probably why a lot of them end up in foster homes.
What's so great about the foster home?
Well,
You know, I'm being facetious when I say these things,
yeah,
but I'm really not.
Yeah.
I'm really serious. What's so great about them that they all want to go to foster home?
The thing that I've perceived from talking to the kids is they feel that a foster home, they feel their parents are unreasonable and a foster home wouldn't be. That kid, people that have foster homes have because they like kids, they'll give you more freedom, and, you know. And we've had girls in this area, specifically, maybe it's because I remember the girls' cases better. There's been some recently where it's obvious manipulation on their part, where they've been in four or five foster homes. There's been boys in the same situation too, but recently it's been girls. That, you know, it is almost a manipulation to the point of they want to get someplace where somebody will let them do whatever they want to do, which means if they want to stay out at night, that's fine. If they want to go home in a couple of days, that's fine. Or whatever. And not necessarily where they have to be home every night at a certain hour, or, you know, if there's bad company and the foster parents or the parents say, hey, you know, that guy's bad news or that gal's bad news, don't hang around with them, then they don't like that infringement, and so they'll run. And it becomes a lifestyle, and then they will infest other kids with this ideology also, because they'll see them at school, and I've heard it myself. You know, I've talked to kids, I've talked to parents that have heard it, where they'll go to school or they'll see them down at the show, midnight show, or out at the fair, or, you know, whatever, and say, well, run away. You know, get into a foster home. It's easier in a foster home. You get into a foster home and things will be better. And it kind of this nebulous idea of, you know, greener pastures and whatnot. And then when they get into foster homes, they find out that the foster parents normally, once in a while, they find foster parents who really don't care. Maybe they're doing it because of the money or whatever. And so they'll take the kids, and they don't care what the kids do, but if they get into a decent foster home, they put the same restrictions and the same thing on, and so they run again.
Is that the picture for most of the kids, though, that you're painting, that they're manipulating the foster home program so they get more freedom, or is that, you know, what proportion are we talking about?
I'm not talking about all the kids in foster homes, no.
Well, I know. I understand that the physically abused people is just almost a negligible fraction. It's a tragedy, but it's not a great proportion of people that run away. They don't run away for those reasons. But are you indicating that most of the children that run away are running away for rather what we would consider perhaps frivolous reasons, but they may consider very important, but it isn't because of any severe problem at home. It's just that they have some sort of disagreement.
Yeah, the habitual runaway. Now, you've got cases where there's a one-time runaway or something, you know, or maybe two, and that's pretty much it. But the kids that are running away all the time, where, you know, sometimes, like, the police department here used to have a little card, contact card, and every time they had contact with a juvenile for violation of crime, they'd list it on there. And you could pull these cards out, you know, 10-9, 69, runaway, 12-4, 69, runaway, 1-3, 70, runaway, you know. The kids that are going all the time now, I think, you know, when kids run away, sometimes it's because they really see problems or really feel there's problems at home, whether it be with their parents or themselves or whatever. And I think you'll find kids that run away for that reason. I think you'll find kids who feel that their problems, if there aren't, they'll make problems out of things. And whether it be that they can't get their way, they feel this is a big problem.
I can understand that spectrum. What I'm trying to get at is from, you know, from your experience. Everybody feeds everything through their own experience. Mine, I know, is really parochial and limited. Almost all the people I've known that have run away have been younger brothers and sisters of my friends, and they've all run away for seemingly good reasons. You know, they've all run away from home situations that haven't been, you know, they haven't been physically abused, but they've been, you know, really pretty bad situations that I would almost counsel them to run away rather than stay and go through that kind of an emotional traumatic experience. You know, parents that have really been, you know, on the verge of psychotic episodes. And so that's just my own experience. I don't know what portion
some
of the
runaways are. You know, problems lead to problems. And like we've got situations where a lot of kids are running away. One family, for example, there's no mother. And the father's gone most of the time, out of town. And the kids are just left to their own means. In a home, a nice home, but nevertheless, have really no supervision. And this is one particular family got involved in. And you can count, you know, it's almost like the faces of the moon. These kids are going to run away. even to the point where some of them have been removed from the family. Some were sent to relatives somewhere else, but they're running away. And sometimes it's because of problems they see. Sometimes when they've been put in foster homes, they haven't liked it because of the restrictions placed on it, because they weren't used to restrictions, even though they were, you know, things that should have been placed on them a long time ago. But they got them, they didn't like them, so they ran. In fact, these are out of this family, these are some of the kids that are kind of passing this philosophy on to other kids. We've got families where the parents are sick, and like one family where the children have run away, the psychiatrist sent the family home, in the psychological report we got, said the whole situation was like a zoo. But, and consequently, because of, you know, the parents were sick, the kids sick, and even though treatment's been tried, the foster homes that the child was placed in have not worked out. And basically, it's been the same complaint of the child. Well, this, that, and the other thing is building what it amounted to as the child didn't get away. I'm not meaning to say that every kid that runs away is running away to manipulate the system, because that's not the case. I think probably a great percentage of the habitual runaways do, with this in mind. They've learned this type of behavior. We had a, well, he's 12 now, but we had a boy that we started with when he was 8. That
but it's not just manipulating, it's just about manipulating it for other than, you know, serious reasons.
Yeah, other than problems at home. That, yeah, the 11-year-old, or this boy that's 12 now, started when he's 8. There were some burglaries and things like this. It was a real poor family situation. As far as supervision, the state took custody. Tried 3 or 4 foster homes, kept running. Just weekly, he'd run away. So they tried, he was too young to put in jail, obviously. They tried Jesse Lee Home in Anchorage, and he kept running from there. And finally, he knew if he ran enough that he wanted to get back home with his mother. His mother decided to move out of Alaska, where maybe she'd get her kids back. So he kept running, because he felt if he kept on running, he'd be able to get what he wanted. And unfortunately, the state was in a position where they ran out of, finally, they took him home to California and sent him to his mother to go here. Because we turned him over to California Youth Authority, but he's too young to put in a locked institution, yet left his own devices, and he'd run, he'd steal, and everything else. He was a very disturbed young man. And the facilities we had weren't available, but they tried foster homes and things like that. And he knew he did not have to put up with that foster home. And they tried 2 or 3 with him, I can't remember. Then they tried Jesse Lee for a year, and it was a weekly occurrence, and things like that. And there are kids who do utilize the system this way, and probably a high percentage of the habitual runaways. But, you know, there is a difference, too, because there are some kids who run away a lot, and there are some kids who don't run away, except maybe once or twice. And you know, therein would lie some difference in that. But some of them have become very, very court-wise. Very system-wise, and know what they can do and do it. And you know, these kids have problems. There's no doubt about it. And you know, maybe it's a learned way of behavior from the home too, which I'm sure that they're a product of their environment. There's no question about that. But if that's, you know, the way the situation is.
Mrs.
Miller,
Mr. Woods, I'd like to say first that I think that your explanation or analyzation of the present runaway law is probably one of the most complete, precise, and intelligent explanations I have ever heard of the problems connected with the runaway bill. And you're right, I think it's just a matter of confusion. I was talking to some parents a short time back and see if this doesn't fall into what you're finding out. Like the state troopers, the parent calls the trooper to pick up the child. Well, maybe they pick the child up. I mean, it could be that situation. The child says, no, I don't want to go home. You're talking, here's your manipulation. I want to be sent to social services. The parent's on the phone to the police. The police said, I'm sorry, we can't bring your child back. So, there is the confusion as the parents believing that the police will not assist them, which is not correct. The police cannot take them home if the child doesn't want to go. And don't you think this is causing a lot of public confusion? I know a lot of parents that I talk to feel that no one is responding to them to get the children back. Wouldn't it stand to reason on these type of cases that if we had a detention facility, and please note I didn't say jail, or foster home, that where we picked up a runaway or a dependent child or whatever, and placed that child in an unlocked, if you please, detention facility or receiving home, let's call it a receiving type of a facility, where we could then contact someone to investigate the situation, to contact the child and then contact the family and try to make an analyzation of what's the problem before we just say, well, we've got to do something with him. Kid walks into social services right now. They've got to be concerned with feeding him, getting a roof over his head, so they put him out in the first foster home they had. It is not matched. The home isn't matched to the child, or there's no investigation done at all. They don't even know what the child's problems are at that point. They can't even investigate the home in that short period of time. And perhaps this is the problem why we're having to continue running away, because obviously if the child is not happy because of having to conform with rules and regulations, he's not going to stay anyplace, regardless of where you put him. Wouldn't it make sense if we had a receiving type of facility and did our investigation first and then place the child? And do you think that it would be so detrimental to that child to be kept in a receiving type of facility for a few days until this can be done, even a week?
I think we're desperately in need of a situation like that. We, Youth Incorporated used to fill this gap of a receiving home. I know there used to be a Baptist receiving home in Anchorage, and there used to be one in Juneau. I don't know what's become of either one. I don't know if they still have them. But, we find ourselves in this situation many times where we find ourselves with a child who really does not belong in jail. But yet, there are no foster homes available in Fairbanks. And right now, we have a young lady in detention. We just went to court out this afternoon who is a runaway from another state. And probably she wants to go back home, and it's just a matter of arranging for transportation. But in the meantime, we have no place to put her. There are no foster homes available. There are no group homes available. The only group institutions in the area, my hospitality house, it would be ludicrous for them to bring in strange kids and mingle them into their program when they're working on a long-term basis with the clients they have there at this point. And because they wouldn't know what they'd be getting in on, as far as problems. The same way with Bill Gris, once it starts operating again. We need a facility that's not a lockup facility, that's in a situation like you described. Even right now, for example, if we got a child who were an abuse case or a neglect case, a teenage child, the chances of finding a place other than jail are almost nil.
You don't have any foster homes? Are the foster homes you have full?
They're all full.
How many do you have in the...
I don't know. I know welfare, and talking to them just recently, they had conducted a campaign to acquire some more foster homes. And I know Division of Corrections up until a month ago had a one of their workers working specifically on finding foster homes. And the plain fact is people just don't want to take kids in. Not very many people anyway. The people that did respond to the campaign wanted sweet little babies. And, you know, little. But when you come to the teenager, whether the teenager has problems or not, whether the teenager is a real fine person or is scum of the earth, there just aren't a heck of a lot of people who really want to take them into their home. And this, you know, we've looked. For example, when we take cases down to Division of Corrections after court, or over to welfare, we'll sit down with them, and if we have a case where we feel alternate placement of the home is necessary, we'll call them in advance and say, well, here's the situation. Well, we're probably going to have to make some kind of a placement. And it becomes a real hair-raising experience. It's to the point that the foster homes that are available now are overcrowded. And people are taxed to their limit. And, you know, it's really, really bad. The people who are willing have come forth and have kids. And in some cases, they have more than they really thought they wanted in the first place. But they're good people, and they'll subject themselves to that. But the rest of the people, you know, maybe don't want to. We just don't have the facilities. There's been a couple foster homes screened out because, you know, they may have had kids for other reasons than other, just genuinely wanting to help, either for the money that they get from the state or whatever. Or maybe it's a good way to get labor, or maybe it's a way to get companionship for their kids, or, you know, not necessarily because they're really truly interested in the kids and wanting to help with the kids. But there is a critical shortage of foster placements and foster homes. In Fairbanks, anyway.
On the runaway situation here in Fairbanks, have you noticed that you've had a sharp increase since the kids have kind of got the word that you don't like to be at home, you can run away and you put someplace else where you don't have to mind quite as much?
Well,
your runaways increased noticeably in the last year?
We had a noticeable decrease because the police quit reporting them, and so consequently there was, you know, the parents would call in and the police say, we can't do anything, you know, if you want to put it on the board, but we can't stop them, we can't pick them up or do anything. And so for that period of time until October, I guess it was, I think it was the first part of October when the new law came into effect rescinding the old law, there was nothing. And so all of a sudden, you know, we had no statistics on runaways whatsoever.
But your local police departments both know now, both the state troopers and the local authorities, that they can pick up a runaway child?
Well, I think so. But this is the problem we keep running into, because even as early as last week, or as late as last week, I had calls from parents, like the parents from Anchorage who called to have their daughters apprehended, called and got the response that the police cannot pick up a runaway unless they call juvenile intake and get a detention order from juvenile intake.
Oh, it's one of the juvenile intake officers. And you could make a couple of phone calls to the chief of police and the head of your troopers here and advise them that there is a statute so that they can...
Yeah. We have, which is what stifles me, is because we've done this on a couple of occasions to the point of personally going. Now, city police have been real good, really have. The problem seems to be the state troopers. It might be just in communication, and it might be just maybe the people that, as far as I can tell, the people that the parents are talking to aren't necessarily the officers or the troopers, it's the clerks. And there might be the problem. But what I'm doing now is I've just drafted a memorandum for my secretary, citing the statutes number and so forth, and pretty much quoting it verbatim to send over and say, please make sure all your people know this, because there have been problems. I had a parent last week, or 2 weeks ago, that came in, and their son, who was 16, had been camping out for about 7 months, and had at that point been arrested for violating a crime. And the parents came in, and of course, the first question is, why don't you have your son at home? And they were astonished. Well, how can we? You know, we can't pick him up. There's no runaway law. And then we explained to them that there was a runaway law. And the father happened to be an old Italian, and he just all of a sudden got up in the chair. He said, aha, now let me tell you something. You know, you're coming home, and you're going to stay home. He said, now that I know what my rights are, then, you know.
The statute doesn't say that.
Yeah.
The parents don't have any rights under the statute.
But the father at least found out that he could at that point, because he was under the impression that the old law had been rescinded and that they couldn't be apprehended and there's no way to control it. And so once he found out that there were some controls, then he felt, you know, mm-hmm. he took a little bit more of a hand in the whole situation, which showed some, you know, encouragement in that particular situation. But there was, I don't have the statistics to prove it, but I do know that the incident of runaway increased considerably after the runaway law was rescinded and the new thing came in about going to welfare and you know. And I know that the welfare office was overwhelmed with kids coming in over mundane problems to the point where they really became against real problems because they just didn't have the staff or the personnel to handle the volume. And we found ourselves in the same situation. We'd have kids coming in too, and they wouldn't go home. And so we'd have to refer them to welfare, and we'd refer case after case after case. The poor workers, you know, geez, they'd just be deluged with these cases. And, you can't be effective in that case, because when you're investigating an abuse or whatever, you have to do a big study. You want to make sure you protect the child's rights, but you also want to make sure you don't violate the parents either. And this would be a real problem.
Mrs. Davis, did you have your hand?
I just wanted to know if there was some place for these kids to go, someone who could hear their dregs. It sounds like you just simply have a friendly ear somewhere.
Yeah, well, I think...
There isn't one available to them short of doing this.
Yeah. That's one of the things we tried to do in our office, although we don't publicize the newspaper. There was a group of people that had a project going a few months ago that wanted to establish a runaway house in Fairbanks, similar to one that was in San Francisco or somewhere in the Southern California area. And they had visited the runaway house in California. They had gotten all the materials and documentation and letters and whatnot. And they were to the point of developing a board of directors and trying to find a house and establish this. But I don't know what's happened. I don't know if they couldn't get the support they needed or whatever. I know the intensive care unit for the Division of Corrections was kind of an open door setting, hoping that kids with problems would come in. Although they're geared for a small caseload and for the kids that are assigned. I know that our office is open and we'll sit down and at any time, any kid that have problems, we'll try to help. If it's if they have problems with the parents, they will do what we can. But we'll, the way we act, we pretty much call a spade a spade, and if we know that the problem is with the child, then we'll tell them so. You know, but we try to deal with it realistically. I think Division of Family and Children Services also still has their open door thing too, so kids can still go to the Family and Children Services and see them. The possibility of them coming in and relating a problem being immediately placed into a foster home or alternate setting would be pretty nil, because before anybody would do it or before we would recommend it, you know, we'd want to look into the matter more. But we're sure available. I think the most common place we get referrals now on family problems where there's abuse is from school counselors. During the winter months, anyway, if they come in prior to running away, then it's usually through school counselors. Once in a while, kids will come into our office, or once in a while, they'll go to welfare, but the majority of them will. And which, you know, stands to reason, because the counselors are helping with other things, and the word counselor, you know, has certain implications, and the kids have the contact and the access, where they may not think of coming to welfare or coming to youth aid or whatever.
Was this an independent group?
Yes. It was on the same nature of the group that started getting incorporated.
Something like this would be very weird if it was, if the direction given to the children at this point in time was
I talked to the people at Hillcrest about this too, because they were, at that time they were operating, and they were thinking about building a new facility up by the university, and they've got this house downtown. And the suggestion had been given them to see if they considered developing a receiving home in the town area with the house they have there. And they could still move to their other facility. However, they haven't built the other facility, although they're getting closer to it, I guess.
I understand they have 140 acres. Is that given to them?
Yeah, it was a believe it was some kind of a grant or donation. I can't remember by whom, but it's specifically for their use for a child treatment facility. Because they had explored the possibility of selling half of it to get the funds to build on the other half, but they can't do that. But they do have...
Do they have to be out of their present building?
No. Their present building, the only problem is it's an older house and it's in the middle of town, which adds problems to treating kids with emotional problems.
Well, I understand most of the kids that were there were brought in from Barrel. They weren't Fairbanks kids.
Quite most of them were out-of-town kids, Barrel or Nome or Kotzebue. The highest percentage of the population were from other areas of the state. But the house, they had older kids, and the house did leave access to the downtown area.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Miller.
What we read in, or what the situation that I read into that was very much a great deal of concern to me in these type of community facilities was a situation that has happened, and it's happened many times, and it's happening right now, and particularly in Anchorage. Now, I don't know. Social services or family social services contracts with nonprofit independent groups such as Jesse Lee Hope. And in turn, such functions or such groups like Jesse Lee Hope have contracted with another group under federal grants and programs or subcontractors. Family services has got this, there's a group out here in the community, three times removed from the parent and from the immediate direction of that child. And some of these groups that are small groups have been counseling these children without direct supervision have caused a few problems. For example, some of these so-called counselors are social. The parents think they're social workers because they're three times removed. And they've had such cases as a caseworker, a counselor telling the parents that the reason Susie is running away is you just don't seem to understand that at age 14, Susie has an unfulfilled sexual need and it's all right for her to spend the evening with this man, etc. And there are documented cases in court in this. We also had a situation where we were dealing with a fourth group of subcontractors through this same social services that branches out into the community until we lose track of it. And we had a brand new group. The child walks into this group and asks for help. He says, I don't want to go home. And immediately they took it upon themselves to locate a place for this child to be housed. The law reads that family social services must advise the parents within 48 hours that child is in their custody and also notify the court. In this case, this group so far removed did not know to notify the family. The family didn't know where this child was for a period of a week, I guess. Neither did the court. Now, this family has a clear-cut case against the state of Alaska. We're opening ourselves up to a big liability sometimes if we branch these things out in the community without doing immediate supervision or immediate ties. Would you concur with that?
Right. I think I'm just speaking for that.
I see you. Go ahead. I see you. I started asking.
Notifying parents, maybe because Fairbanks is smaller, we really haven't had too much of a problem. And immediately notifying parents, or usually it's at the time of apprehension or within 24 hours. Once in a while, if we have a child that lives in a remote area, like way up the Steese or Elliott or something like that, the troopers are real good as far as notifying parents, but it's there really haven't been any problems. There was, may I get some coffee?
Sure.
Well, what we are actually talking about is the receiving facility, so, which is what I was, a cooling off place.
I finally figured out what you can see. Well, Brad, is this, what we need is a Wagner rack that will...
Sick of it, but we're so, and it came originally from the I think he was head of one of the services in Utah. We're so busy pulling them out of the water, we don't have time to go upstream to see what's pushing them in. Now, it isn't getting any better. The situation isn't getting any better. And I'd like, if at all possible, this committee, sure, we have to do something with the present problem, but preventative, do something preventative medicine in this case. Now, where do you think the fault lies? We know it lies partially in family, partially in schools.
Well,
are you convinced that that our schools are too permissive also? Now, by that, I'm talking about, I don't know what your situation is here, but I was absolutely shocked to find out we had Loomis guards on duty at our schools in Anchorage.
I think they're on guard at the high school. They were last year because of vandalism.
This is during school hours. You know, I can understand it at night, but this is during school hours. We have Loomis guards at every one of our high schools, junior high schools, practically Montessori and kindergarten are the only ones we don't have in Anchorage.
In the state,
but this seems, you know, pretty far out. Even for me, of course, I'm of another generation, but I live right near a high school and I've always had good rapport with all the school kids, but it seems to me that somewhere along the line, and you can go up to West High any day of the week, if those, you know, the classes that are going on, you know those kids are supposed to be in classes, they're outside sitting on the lawn or they're having a jive session at one end of the West High hall. So to me, there are going to have to be some rules and regulations, and some our school boards are locally, and I think it, you know, I don't think it's a state, you can't legislate this statewide. It has to be, it's a local problem. And I think somewhere along the line, our school boards are failing.
But I think they're failing too miserably to be able to pull it out by passing more discipline.
They don't have any discipline now. What do you mean more?
But if they said more, if they said pass regulations saying nobody can skip any class without getting, you know, expelled from school, I just don't think it would work.
I don't think that expelling them, I think only, it has to be pretty drastic before they should be expelled. But Redwood County in Minnesota, I just happened to come through there on my way back from Chicago. And I don't know where, if any of you know where it is in Minnesota, do you? Redwood County?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
some of the towns. I'm from South Dakota.
Oh, well, Morgan, Redwood Falls.
Oh, I know Redwood Falls.
Well, this county all of a sudden just went up in arms in the last 2 years. And their school boards set some pretty tough regulations, pretty tough by the standards today. If a child didn't obey the rules and regulations of the school, they stayed up after an hour each day for a week, the first offense, and an hour each day for 2 weeks, a second offense, and no kid wants to stay after school an hour when every other kid is gone. You know? And they said that there was a marked change by mid-semester last year in the discipline in that school. They were very happy. Now, I talked to principals and I talked to teachers on this. And whether, you know, whether this is a solution, but at least if they're gaining any points at all, because the kids are just walking in and out of school as they want to today.
Well, I think a lot of the problems is a change in lifestyle. A lot of kids identify with this so-called hippie culture or whatever. And, you know, it's very easy today for a young person to leave home and to survive somewhat comfortably no matter where he goes. Anywhere in Alaska or out of Alaska, there's always places he can sleep, places he can eat, get handouts, get rides. So it's very simple. And I think this, you know, the typical picture of a hippie going from town to town or living in a commune or a big camp somewhere or something, and of course we have that type of personnel up here, appeals to at least a certain segment of the kids that might have those tendencies. And I think in Fairbanks, and I don't know about Anchorage because I haven't been there for a long time on a long-term basis, but our class structure I don't think is very solid. You know, we don't have middle class, especially in the schools. All the kids mingle in one group. And we have one high school, so that the kids that are bad or good or in the middle are all socially intermingling. And that way I think the ideas of the bad can infiltrate to the good, and it seems to be more that way than the other. And I don't know if it's just the schools. I don't think that's, you know, that's the only problem. I think there's problems in the homes, even the good home, because I think it used to be kids that play a pretty important part in the family. Where now, you know, a typical family goes home at night to watch TV, and there's not a lot of interaction. There's not a lot of anything except getting up during the commercial to have a Coke or something, which I think tends to lead to a very shallow family life. And I think the vital relations that the kids need and want then shift to their peers, to their friends, which becomes more important than the family as far as attitudes and ideas towards life and lifestyles. And the families lose control of their kids then go elsewhere other than home. They still love for mom and dad, but probably by the time you get into junior high, but at least senior high, more important in your thought pattern is your friends at school. And if they have diverse ideas, and the tendency would be for you to go with them too. And you know, I think this might have something to do with it too, other than, you know, because and kids aren't important in the home. You don't need them to, you know, they, now there's a few chores they do, which are kind of, but it's not important to survival of the family like it used to be. The typical American family and life is a lot easier.
Would you say, though, that I'm struck sometimes by the parents who have really loved their children and are deeply hurt by the fact that some of their children are running away, anymore like they used to, but from their peers. And the problem with getting it from your peers is your peers really don't know what's happening. Your peers are only 14 years old and really don't know what, you know, how they know a lot about the way the world is perhaps because they live in it, but they don't really have a philosophical model to behave by that's really a functional one, or one that gives some sort of meaning to your life. And so they kind of just drift aimlessly and they get into lots of trouble that way and lots of confusing situations.
Yeah, immaturity to the point of not being really realistic about what, like we had a young lady a couple weeks ago that just a continual runaway, and I would say one that was, you know, trying to manipulate 15, she either wanted a foster home where she could do what she wanted or wanted emancipation on her own, both of which were unrealistic because you couldn't find the foster home to satisfy her and you can't just say, okay, go do it. So She said, well, I can get a job, I can support myself. So I said, all right, so you're going to get a job. How much are you going to make? Let's just talk about fasting. How much is it going to cost you to live for an apartment, for food, for clothing, you know, car? And so she gave some figures that really didn't jive. So let the judge at that point said, all right, do what? You stay at the jail at night every morning, you can go to work, you can save some money. At the end of 30 days, you come back with the budget. Show me what you've got in the bank. Show me the apartment you're going to rent. And, you know, if things look feasible, then we'll, you know. And the parents really didn't like the whole idea, but they agreed to it. And it lasted about 4 days, and she just didn't come back. And it was in California, where she is right now. Because she just wasn't realistic, and a lot of kids will do this. It's easy to go out when you're a runaway to flop in somebody's house, friends or, you know, usually older kids, but when it comes down to actual, realistically, you know, surviving and maintaining a decent lifestyle without reverting to shoplifting or something like that for survival, without sponging all the time, I don't think a lot of the kids really comprehend this. It's fun, you know. We had a boy 3 weeks ago from he ran away from Ohio. He's picked up at the border. And being in this district, he was brought here. That was having a ball. This was his third runaway in 3 months. He'd gone from his dad's in Panama City, Florida, to his mom's in Ashtabula County, Ohio. And then he ran away from her house, went to Texas for a while, California, until he was finally picked up, sent back, and he thought that was a ball, so he took off to see if he could get to Alaska, because it was remote. And it wasn't really that things at home were so bad, but he was just having a plain old everyday ball. He was traveling, he was seeing the country, meeting a lot of people, and, you know, getting handouts all the time, things like this. Real problem to other people. You know, he knew that once he ran out of money, he got in a spot that somebody sent him home. And realistically, what you might do with a kid like that is take him to the exactly how to get back. But you can't hope for someone wildly or something like that. But I think this, you know, a lot of the kids that do run away, you know, it's for reasons like this at the home. Even though there's love there, it's not like it used to be. It really isn't. There isn't that bond. And your friend has an idea, it sounds good. Everybody does. And it's, a lot of times it's not necessarily that there's such a grievous problem at home, but it's kind of the thing to do.
Madam Chair, this is mine. Mr. Woods, we've heard testimony up in Nome, which I thought was really struck a chord. It says that we as adults assume that a child has more maturity than he does. This goes back to what Mr. Meekins was saying. I think kids are getting their information from their peers. It's a very young group. And it goes back to what Mrs. Fish was saying, more guidance from our schools. I mean, it has to be a joint effort between schools and parents. But, for example, what you just said, this judge said, well, all right, probably sit down, and the budget that the child presented to us was totally unrealistic. And we knew that to begin with. And yet we assume that if it's proven to her on her own, that we're going to give her instant maturity. And instead she just ran again. And I think that's just a classic example of us as adults kind of throwing our responsibility by passing the buck too.
And I think, on the other hand, you know, you can't explain it to her either because she wouldn't accept it. You know, you could sit there and show her the loopholes in her budget.
In this case, do you think that, since you had no other place to put her, that possibly had you kept her in detention long enough to cool off, that in a few days or weeks she might have said, well, home wasn't so bad after all, and gone home? Are the possibilities of you losing track of her in California, winding up with your unwed mothers, or hooked on drugs or something else? That's a good possibility, too.
She's in custody in California. That's how we know she's there.
I see.
Pending transportation arrangements back, but this particular girl, I don't know. She's pretty wild.
How old was she?
15.
Sounds like to me we don't do enough to salvage these kids out.
Well, there's problems in that area too, and, you know, having the time and the proper facilities too, which we don't have enough personnel in the different departments. There's just not enough money to hire. But, you know, like welfare, I know they're just overwhelmed with cases. A caseload of 120, 130 at times.
Well, I think corrections, if I'm correct, I have here somewhere. I think it grew from 5 people in 1960 to, how many is it today? Corrections and probation?
Statewide? I don't know.
I have it here somewhere. But
I think there's five probation officers working in Fairbanks.
Madam Chairman,
Mr.
While we're paused for a moment, I just shared with someone else a thought. Maybe there was a great author many years ago who was also a humorist who might get quite a kick out of this legislative committee and the whole legislature's problem with the runaway bill, and I refer to one Mark Twain. I think some of the things that we're hearing, if he were around, he would laugh a little bit at how the legislature has gotten into some of the problems.
Could I just, I found this. The Alaska Division of Corrections is now over 11 years old. It has grown from an initial staff of less than 5 shortly after statehood to a major agency of the state government with more than 350 full-time employees. That's a lot in 11 years.
Unfortunately.
So there's something we're not doing right somewhere along the line.
Unfortunately, though, out of that 350, they're not all caseworkers. This is where, you know, where they really need the help.
It's administrative and secretarial.
Yeah, I don't know where they're all at. I know, like in Fairbanks, we have 5 probation officers that are working probation officers, and they have a caseload of mixed with adults and juveniles. They're sometimes up to as many 90 cases apiece, which if they were to work with the kids, you know, that maybe be, considering the 7.5-hour day, 5 days a week, 20 minutes a month that they'd be able to spend with these kids. You know, realistically, you can't do anything. I know there's problems like that. I don't know how, you know, I'm sure they need the administrative personnel because they need to take care of budgeting and everything else, policy and whatnot. But I think they do need more workers. One problem, I don't know if you all can help with. I talked to the Division of Corrections in Juneau. I talked to welfare here and Division of Corrections here, which didn't come up till the summer, but we're finding a lot of kids running away from other states coming here that other states aren't willing to take back or pay for the way back, and families and stuff. We're finding ourselves stuck. It's happened 4 times now in the last 60 days with buying tickets for juveniles who are just simply runaways to send them back where they came from, and finding ourselves in a situation where should the state of Alaska assume the responsibility and the cost of raising these kids, or should the state assume the responsibility and the cost of sending them back? Because we're finding ourselves, we had 2 boys from North Dakota about 60 days ago, and both cases in that particular instance have to be families that were active welfare recipients in North Dakota, and North Dakota refused to bring them back, and the families refused to bring them back. One mother was ordered by the juvenile court. One court said, well, you know, he's up there. If you get him back, we'll do something about him. And the mother was ordered to, by the other court in the other county, said, you will bring that boy back. And the mother said, maybe. And refused. And it ended up where Division of Corrections issued a travel voucher and flew them back to North Dakota. And then this boy from Ohio came up, and we found ourselves in the same situation. And he went. We ended up with him just 2 weeks ago, buying a ticket back. And right now we have this young lady in detention, where the family says, we have absolutely no money. We can't bring him back. And I've talked to welfare, and welfare says, well, they're not active recipients, so we can't. And so again, it looks like we're again being faced, and it just burns me up that we're being faced with this burden that, you know, the taxpayers in this state have to provide transportation, free transportation, on an airliner for some kids who decided they wanted to see this part of the country. And I don't know if, I know there's, for example, there's an interstate agreement that of only 7 or 14 states have signed so far, which, and I don't think Alaska's signed it yet. Florida has. I don't know if California has, where the states agree that if a runaway from one state is picked up in another, that the home state agrees to, within 5 days, return that juvenile to their own state.
Sir, do you know the name of what it's called? The compact of some.
There's also the Interstate Compact on Juveniles, which is a little bit different, but it's an agreement between, well, 49 of the 50 states have signed it. I think Utah is the only one that has it. Whereby if juveniles are apprehended in other states, that there's an interstate agreement. And this is all the governors signed, where the states agree to return the juveniles.
But now in this case, wouldn't the juveniles be paid by the other states that they came from then?
They should be, but the other states just haven't. Mr. Massengill, excuse me, is the individual who's on the interstate desk in Juneau, and I've talked to him on a couple occasions about this, and he seems to feel our hands are tied. I went to the governor's office, even with the North Dakota boys, to see if our governor or somebody from the governor's office could contact somebody in a similar position in North Dakota. They didn't want to get involved at that point over a couple hundred dollars. I think it was $400 it cost us to send it back. Whatever the reasons were, they didn't feel it was appropriate for them to do at that time. But I think Alaska needs to get into some of them, because I know any kid that's run away from the Fairbanks area in the lower 48, we've had them back here within 2 or 3 days from when we've been notified. Now, I don't know if the rest of the state's been operating that way. But to me, it's the home state's problem. Now, the boy that we sent back, we knew there were family problems and that he shouldn't be placed home. So we sent him back to the agency and not to the home, but we sent him back to the home state because we felt that that's where the problem was and that's where the responsibility lay, and it really shouldn't be placed upon Alaska.
But there are 14 states that have signed an agreement.
The runaway agreement, right. Mr. Massengill could probably give you the proper name of it.
I think we'd better sign up.
Madam Chairman, if I'm not mistaken, and I wanted to ask Mr. Manning on this, if my memory serves me well, we heard testimony to the contrary on this in Juneau. Do you recall we had some testimony on this as to exchange of minors that were in a runaway state?
No, I don't think so. I don't recall it.
Or was that correctional?
We definitely are signatory to the Interstate Compact on Juveniles. I think that's correct.
We are.
I don't know.
But this other runaway agreement is separate to the Interstate Compact. Uh-huh. It deals specifically with runaways, although the Interstate Compact in its sections does refer to runaways. I think the Interstate Compact requires you to take them to court, adjudicate them, and then transfer them so that when they arrive in the other state, it's transferring from, say, the Division of Corrections or Welfare in Alaska to the Division of Corrections or Welfare in the receiving state.
Under our present statutes, I don't think you can return that child home.
To try to find...
He can go to social services
and
under our statute.
Put in a resolution
to him to another
state to join the 14 states that have...
Right. I have a question.
Mr. Manning?
Well, they want to go home.
Oh, okay.
Madam Chairman, I hate to interrupt you, but the telephone call was it's necessary for our witness to call his office before 4:30. So could we have a 5-minute recess?
Well, certainly. Well, Mr. Manning had a question first. Is that all right?
How did these out-of-state juveniles come into contact with the criminal justice system here?
The two boys from North Dakota, I'm trying to remember now. The boy from Ohio and the girl from California all of them turn themselves into the police agents, just getting them to run away from another area.
Well, they simply came in and said, here we are.
Yeah, I ran away from home in Ohio or whatever, and that's how we came across. That's really most of them. You know, it's a situation where they get a free trip, they go to the house, and it's manipulation to a certain extent.
And they'll all get there.
It's a racket. It really is. It's an opportunity, you know. If I were a kid, you know, why not? I want to go to Florida, and I've never been there. Then get down there, and once you run out of money, or you get tired or scared or whatever, you go into the police, say, hey, I'm from Alaska. I want to go home. And phone call 2 days later, you're on a big jet. Away you go.
Well, even their parents might even pay their way up. Who knows?
Yeah.
Saying, you know, one way, kid. The
one mother from North Dakota did say, when I talked to her, she says, I tell you what, she says, I'll send them $15. You can let them hitchhike back. And we wouldn't do that, because just about the time we'd let them hitchhike back, he'd get across the border and get run over by a Mack truck. And in Alaska, be sued for $500,000 because he deprived the mother of her dear, beloved son that she will miss the rest of her life. She's concerned about him to the tune of $12.
Is there any state law to require a parent to
be responsible for it? This is the thing, you know, if we have a child going out and we have to pay him back, we still have recourse, even if it means, you know, going to small claims court. Because then the state would still have the recourse to reimburse ourselves for the expense of bringing an Alaskan child back. So that, but on the other hand, if, for example, the two boys are not, well, any of these, if the other states decide they don't want to pay us, we're kind of up the creek without a paddle, because, you know, how can we sue another parent in another state? We'd have to go to federal court to expend. Everything would be just outrageous. Or maybe to a collection agency, which, you know, but yet it's a whole bunch of red tape and entanglements, where if the home state would take care of it, it would be a lot easier for them to do it, and it'd be a lot easier for us. A child in the Fairbanks area, we can call the parents and say, okay, buy the ticket. Or in cases in the past where the parents haven't had the money, say, look, we don't have the money now, but we can pay you in 60 days. We'll issue the TR, and sure enough, they've come in. And if they haven't, we've called them. And, you know, there's never been any problem in collecting from local parents. But when it's the other way around, then we're kind of in a quandary, and it's hard to handle.
Madam Chairman, I assume without knowing, and I will look it up, that this interstate compact on juveniles, I assume it relates only to juveniles who come into the criminal justice system by some act in that foreign state or in that sister state. Is that correct?
Well, there is a section that applies to runaways who have not violated any criminal law. There is a section, for example, that says if the runaway commits a violation, then the state that he's in has 90 days to decide to detain him and to process him and so forth, and notify the home state whether or not they were going to institutionalize him or whatever, and would have the prerogative of keeping him in that state, you know.
Or sending him to the
state. Yeah, or sending him home. But it also says, I've only read it once, and it's been 3 weeks ago now, I can't remember. There is some paragraphs in there of juveniles who have not committed any other offense other than just being a runaway. And under those provisions, I believe we have to take them to court, get him adjudicated a dependent minor or a minor under supervision, placing him in the custody of one of the departments, welfare or corrections, and then sending them interstate back to their home state, which is a lot of red tape. But at that point, then the home state is obligated to assume the responsibility. But that still doesn't take care of the immediate problem, or, you know, like having the kid sit out in jail for a week or 2 weeks. The one boy from North Dakota was almost 2 weeks in jail before finally we just, out of just frustration, we issued a TR to get him out of there, because he shouldn't have been sitting there. Not here. If, you know, maybe they wanted to detain him there, but at least they can start the process to put him someplace where they can work with him. Here, it's just dead space. He's in a little box and being contained and fed.
And it's costing the state
$20-some a day to feed him here, and in the long run, we save the state money. You know, it's cheaper to buy the ticket and get him out of here than it is to keep him in jail for a prolonged period of time or try to raise him.
About how many have you had this summer?
Well, these, you know, we didn't have the problem for a long time. Up until this summer, every out-of-state runaway, we've been able to get the parent to pay. And then suddenly, this summer here, we've got four. Now, in the last 60 days, we're...
fall, and it's getting, you know, time to go back south.
So I...
It's getting cold.
Yeah. Well, time to go back to Florida. Alaska in the summer, Florida in the winter. But it
could become a racket.
Yeah, it could be. The only reason I mentioned it is possibly, you know, there should be something worked out so that when this situation comes up, we know where to go and what to do. The way it is right now, we're issuing orders to welfare or probation saying issue a TR to send this kid back, hoping that the state will get reimbursed. But now, you know, we're talking this summer of in the area of about $1,300, $1,400 cost the state of Alaska to the state to return these kids. Plus the time that they spend in detention and things like this, where it should be almost an automatic thing. A kid comes in from another state, it should be, you know, a matter of calling the state, having the ticket wired up, and again going out the next day or two. It should be almost immediate, because we can't do anything with the child. We aren't doing the child any good, except, you know, if there's problems, then the home agency can, of course, handle it and work with it. And the people in North Dakota assured me that when that kid got off the airplane, he's going to be picked up, he's going to be detained and sent to a reformatory in North Dakota, one of them, because he had just done that a month before to California and got a free ticket back in North Dakota. and then all of a sudden, here he was here. And, I suppose next he would have gone to Florida or something. But he was learning, you know. And that's happened before with our kids going south. They get down there and get tired or hungry, they turn themselves in. It was funny, two summers ago we had a couple of kids from Louisiana that made it all the way up here. The one boy had been stationed here with his father at Wainwright. And that kid got picked up weekly. I mean, the kid couldn't even spit on the sidewalk without having an officer there. He was just unlucky in that respect. You know, public ugliness they get him, no matter what. He got picked up, brought in, and he had a record. All of them minor things, but he was on probation because he's always in trouble. Somebody give him a bottle of beer, he'd get half a swig, and an officer would walk around the corner by chance, you know. So anyway, he got up here, and they'd gone 3 days without food, you know, no place to stay because the people, their friends, were afraid to keep him, afraid they'd get in trouble. So finally they decided they better get picked up, because they were just starved and they wanted to go home. And they stood in front of the court building for 24 hours, all the way through curfew. Nobody knows. They couldn't get picked up for nothing. You know, the police cars going in and out all night, going on their calls and their business, and they just didn't. And finally the next morning they had to go in and say, would you please, we ran away, we can't get picked up. But they thought maybe they'd let the police pick them up and take the prerogative. So they stayed in front of the courthouse all night, you know, past curfew and the whole bit, thinking about getting picked up. It just didn't happen. So it's kind of funny, I guess, when he was here, he just couldn't do anything. But it is a problem. I don't think, that there's any way to legislate a solution to the runaway problem. I think part of it's because of our lifestyle. I do feel that the police need the prerogative to pick up runaways. I also feel that probably it is good that a child has the prerogative of not going home right at that point, because at least you've got a safeguard built in where you don't find a child back in an incestuous situation or an abusive situation or whatever, you know. Even though it's a small percentage, the risk, you know, it isn't worth taking the risk. Even though it might need a night or two in detention or whatever. But I think also that the agencies need the prerogative that when there are no problems other than spending every other night or whatever, you know, if the problems aren't the home, then I think the agencies need to have at least the prerogative of putting the kid back in the home if that's indeed in the best interest of the child, no matter what the child may want. And this might take a few days to find out for sure, because you want to make sure you don't put a child back into a bad situation. But I know we found in a lot of cases where the home really isn't bad. A lot of it might be because of the kid or their associates and wanting to do other things than the home is willing to allow. And we are getting into a situation where the values of the parents and the values of the child are far removed because of the different influences on the two different things, the parents and the child. The child being influenced by friends. And this is where the real problem comes in, because I don't know other than the schools have a good opportunity to work with it, probably more than anyone else, and probably more professionally than anyone else on a day-to-day basis, where they might be able to deal with the kids realistically with this problem. But I don't have the answer.
Madam Chairman, I forget who it was. I think it was a probation officer or two that has testified to the committee that in a real bad home situation, for example, incestuous type thing, where there's a teenage girl, that they will not tell that this is what's going on. Now, how this person or the people that we've heard testify knew they would not tell, since that would be the only way I could think of you could find out, I'm curious to find out why you think it's so small.
Well, I'm sure it's larger than we know about.
Uh-huh.
But maybe it's just that it's inconceivable to me that very many people could, you know, involve themselves in something like that. Although, you know, I was a state trooper for a year, and then I worked for city police for 3 years. And I don't consider myself naive because of the experiences I've had in those two jobs. But yet, you know, it still amazes me. When you come in contact with some of these situations, it's, you know, it's inconceivable is what it amounts to. And maybe you're right. Maybe it's a lot worse than we think it is. The incest cases that I worked when I was at city police, all, I can't remember for sure, there was, all of them came about with the victims telling, either through running away or going to a third party and the third party coming in with them. Sometimes it was the mother, sometimes it was a close girlfriend, or sometimes a counselor. But getting to the point where finally they either ran away and told, or at least prior to running away went in for help to a third party. And you're right, you know, if they don't tell somebody, how are you going to find out? Unless they're accidentally caught in the act by the spouse or something like this, then it might come to light. But all the cases that I worked, and unfortunately there were a few of them, came about in this respect.
Well, of course, it doesn't have to reach that degree before it becomes intolerable for the child.
Right, right. The child may run away a couple times, hoping to get away and hoping that she won't have to reveal this. I know, and this, sometimes you wonder in investigating these things and doing these things, how much harm you do to the child, too. And not only has the child got to face the trauma of what's happening to her there, but also the trauma of testifying, you know, and seeing to it that, you know, her father's arrested and whatever. It might be at that point where there's hate, and this won't bother. But on the other hand, you know, that's still father, no matter what he does. And I've worked in children's institutions in South Dakota and here, and it doesn't matter what the parents do to the child. That child still looks at him as mom and dad, and the only mom and dad they know, and they want to go home. Irregardless, eventually they want to go back home. And very few exceptions are there when they don't want to, which a lot of times seems inconceivable too, considering what they went through at home, including beatings and, you know, the whole nine yards. So it really, I know some states have legislated to the point where for prosecution on things like that, they leave it up to the welfare worker. Which I don't think necessarily, I think it's good in the respect that it protects the child from further harm, but I think it's bad in the respect that it also may not remove a person from society that should be removed from society.
Madam Chairman, one further question. In the Fairbanks situation, who does the investigation? Okay, you have a runaway. Okay, you have no way of knowing why the child ran away. Who looks into the family situation here?
Well, the way our system works here, the initial report comes to our office. And so we have the initial contact. Normally, if a child just runs away and returns home on his own, we won't even see him, because it might be just a couple nights with some friends and they go home. So what we do is we contact the family and the child, indicating, okay, we've got this referral from the police. if there are problems, you know, we'd be glad to help. But we don't think it's serious enough to go to court at this time or anything else. But we give them phone numbers and the office address and stuff and make our office available to them. If the child refuses to go home, then we become immediately involved in the situation. We'll sit down with the child and try to determine why the child doesn't want to go home. Now, if it's a situation where we feel that he's justified and it's, or placement at home is unrealistic at this point either because of continued runaways or problems at home or problems with the child, then we'll involve the appropriate agency, which is normally welfare. We'll call them, get the social worker, we'll fill in the social worker with what we already know, give them a resume of the background, and then the welfare worker, if that be the case, or Division of Corrections, if we would have to go there, would do the detailed family study and background study. And then they would make it into court. But that's normally how it's handled. Unless the child were to want to go into the welfare office, then we wouldn't know about it most likely. But otherwise, that's the normal procedure.
Well, are there any more questions? Well, thank you very, very much. You've given us new food for thought. We certainly appreciate you coming, sir. If we write you on any information, I just write Superior Court, Input Officer, Superior
Intake
Court.
Intake Office.
Intake Officer, Superior Court.
Right. It's room 407.
Just a moment. Remember. Just a moment. Room 407. Would you state your name and your position and also your address? Because I'm trying to get the address.
Ralph Schaefer.
Would you repeat that, please?
Ralph Schaefer, Schaefer.
Huh.
I hold the position of captain of the Alaska State Troopers, commander of I Detachment.
Oh, sorry.
I live at 150 B Street, Hamilton Acres.
B Street?
B.
Hamilton Acres? Please start, Mr. Schaefer, and give us some words of wisdom as far as our problems, as far as the Alaska State Police, if you feel you have any.
Well, I don't claim to be an authority on probation or parole. I didn't come with a prepared testimony. I'll be happy to answer any questions that I can, but if you have.
Well, Mr. Schaefer, I think probation and parole sort of misleading because